I'm rolling. So can you briefly describe the events of September 11th, 1973, as you experienced them in Santiago, Chile?
I was in 1973, I was living in Chile. I had been there for about a year and a half, and I lived quite close to the center of town. We were all of us living in the country at that time, living through a period that approached Civil War characteristics, in which even before the outbreak of the coup, there was lots of activity in the streets, lots of tear gas going off, lots of people throwing rocks. Life had become increasingly difficult. In June, late June of 1973, there was an attempted coup that was put down. We lived in a time of great tension and expectation that, in fact, the military would probably act at some time. On the morning of September 11th, which was a Tuesday, as well as September 11th from the United States of last year, I woke early in the morning, which I usually did, and looked out the window of my apartment building, which faced towards the downtown of Santiago. And rather than seeing traffic coming into the city, which was normal, I saw it going out of the city. That encouraged me to turn on the radio. And in Chile, as in many other countries in the world, news media tended to be quite closely associated with various different political persuasions. So you knew which stations were government-supporting stations and which stations opposed the government. I turned on some government stations and heard that there had been a rebellion among naval troops early that morning in the port city of Valparaiso, and that the Navy troops were marching on Santiago, the capital city where I lived, and that the Army and the other military branches had also revolted. Allende was called upon to resign his presidency and was given assurances of safe conduct out of the country. I kept listening over the morning, and one by one, the government stations would literally be snuffed off the air. In the case of one station, I actually could hear people breaking down the door. It turned out to be military, and the station shortly thereafter going off the air. Towards late morning, those of us who were still listening on the radio heard what turned out to be Allende's last speech to the nation, in which he talked about the military coup, talked about his disappointment in the armed forces, and ultimately told the Chilean people that they would be entering a very, very difficult time in their history, and that he called on them to have courage, to have hope, and said that someday Las Grandes Alamedas, the great avenues, would once again open to the working class, and they would march on them, march on the streets that they again belonged to. The military had given Allende a ultimatum to abandon the presidential palace by early afternoon. Otherwise, it said they would bomb the palace. He didn't accept this, and I stood out on the balcony with a few other people who lived in the apartment complex near me, and we saw up in the sky two jets. They were Hawker Hunter jets provided by the British make jets. And they circled around the sky and came close to the presidential palace. At that time, I think all of us understood that the Chilean system was undergoing a severe strain, but I think even for those most skeptical among us, we thought that a long tradition of the civilian control of the military would not come to an end in Chile and that the military wouldn't carry out their threat. And so when the first pass around over the Moneda, the presidential palace, occurred, the jets went streaked low and then went right back up in the sky. And so we said, see, you know, they just couldn't do it. The force of history, in a sense, was too strong. But they circled once again, and this time you could see the missiles being shot out of the jets. I couldn't see them hit the palace. I couldn't actually see the Moneda from where I lived. But shortly thereafter, there were great balls of black smoke that came up into the air. And at that moment, we knew that, in a certain sense, history had died in Chile, that the past had died, and that we were entering a world that none of us particularly understood at all. That was on a Tuesday. We weren't allowed out of our houses. There was a complete curfew until that Friday. On Friday, we were allowed out for a few hours. I went down and saw the destruction of the presidential palace. By that time, night had turned to day, black had turned to white, everything that one had come accustomed to in not just the 3 years of popular unity, but the many, many years of Chilean democracy. And I had been traveling to Chile since 1963. Those years were all over, and we were into something totally new.
That's incredible. How many people were in the presidential palace that day on September 11th and were killed because of the bombings? And how many people in the city of Santiago died that day as well?
I don't recall the exact number. There were about 2 to 3 dozen people who were inside the palace. Allende had sent most of his close aides out. He had sent, as would be customary for a sort of old-school gentleman as he was, he had sent all the women, all of his women aides out, and so there were only men left. And the only ones who stayed were very close supporters, a few bodyguards, and those who refused to leave him. Probably about a dozen of them were killed in the palace at the time. The rest of them were herded out, those who were still alive, and immediately arrested and sent to a variety of different prisons. There was some fighting over the first few days after the coup, but really there was not a tremendous amount. I think to a certain extent those of us who supported Allende were somewhat surprised that the resistance was not stronger, but ultimately it's not surprising at all. The workers were not armed. The sense that those opposing Allende, that the working class in Chile had been armed and would rise up and that's why some action was needed, was simply not true. And in fact, most of the political parties, including the two largest supporters of Allende, the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, had believed in a history which said that the military wouldn't act. And so they were very unprepared for this kind of a coup. There were estimates of upwards of 5,000 people who were killed in the first few weeks after the coup. And, of course, that's added to by many, many more who were killed during the long years of the dictatorship.
Now, can you talk about how the U.S. was involved in the coup?
The United States had a fairly active presence in Chile for a long period of time. Chile, during the Christian Democratic government, which preceded Allende's, and that would be from 1964 to 1970, became something of a model for the Alliance for Progress of Kennedy and then of President Johnson in the United States. In other words, he was a relatively stable civilian government that in many ways resembled countries in Europe. Here was a chance to make reform work. And in fact, it didn't work. And even without, even given all the levels of U.S. support, there were serious problems in the Chilean economy, which led directly to the election of Allende. When Allende was elected, we're now dealing with a presidency of Richard Nixon, he made it fairly clear, one, that somehow his team had been asleep at the wheel and allowed Allende to be elected, which was surprising of itself. But Allende was elected with a plurality of the votes rather than a majority, as almost every president in the 20th century in Chile has been. That meant that the Chilean Congress had to act to elect the next president among the two, actually all of the vote-getters. Historically, every single case that Congress has elected that person who had the most votes of those who were running. This is when the United States began to actively participate, and documents are present now which suggest that the United States tried very hard to prevent Allende from being confirmed by the Congress, going so far as to support and propagate a plan that can be called nothing less than cockamamie, in that the U.S. provided arms for a band of paramilitary terrorists who were going to kidnap the commander-in-chief of the Chilean armed forces, a man by the name of René Schneider, and suggest that this was an act of the left, and therefore saying to the Congress, look what happens when the left comes to power. They create chaos. The plan went awry. Schneider was killed instead of kidnapped. And it became quite clear that this was done by the right wing and not by the left. And that prevented Allende from being kept out of office. As soon as he came in, the United States made it fairly clear that their major impact would be to, in the words of Richard Nixon, make the economy scream, and to try everything possible to prevent Allende from consolidating power. For the next 3 years, the U.S. cut off all forms of economic aid, all forms of credit, except that going to the military. It isolated Chile to every extent possible. It made it increasingly difficult for Chile to merchandise its copper, which was its main commodity, on world markets. It appears that it manipulated world prices of copper to drive them down by releasing stockpiles of U.S. copper. It made life for Allende absolutely unbearable, at the same time that it supported those forces who wanted to see Allende out, and those would be military forces and including paramilitary forces.
Now, is it true that some of the Navy ships on Valparaiso were actual U.S. Navy ships, as well as Chilean ships?
At the time of the coup, the United States and Chile were holding joint military maneuvers, naval maneuvers called the UNITAS Task Force, which they had held for a number of years before that time. So it's absolutely true that U.S. Navy ships were offshore at the time. There's never been any indication that the U.S. Navy took part in the coup in a military way, but there's lots of suggestions that the U.S. took part in a form of providing communications between Chilean ships and between the Chilean Navy and armed forces. But what I think I would stress is that what the United States did, in a certain sense, was to prepare the terrain, as it often likes to say, for the Chilean military to act in its own interest. The Chilean military at a certain point didn't need a whole lot of support from the United States. The U.S. made those conditions possible, and then the Chilean military acted.
Mm-hmm. And there's also evidence that the CIA actually funded transportation workers to strike in order to paralyze the country and therefore destabilize the government. What do you know about that?
Starting in late 1999, going through the year 2000, the U.S. State Department in particular, under the Clinton administration, began to declassify thousands of documents, which give us a much clearer sense of what happened in Chile, or at least provide the documentary evidence for what many of us had argued for a long time was going on in Chile. Part of that involves U.S. support through intelligence agencies and other branches to provide, as you suggest, support for groups that were intent on destabilizing the political situation in Chile. But let me just suggest one way, and all of those are there, but let me suggest one way in which it becomes easier to see the impact of destabilization. When you talk about a country such as Chile, which has had a long, long history of involvement with the United States, not necessarily nefarious, you're talking about a country whose economy, in one sense, is machined to that of the United States, so that if you walked into a textile mill in Chile in 1970-71, as I did, what you saw there was a big factory filled with machinery made in Massachusetts. If you walked into other plants, you would find that all the machinery came from the United States. If you looked at the Chilean civilian air system, you'd find out that all the planes were made in the United States. Therefore, if you suggest changing some of those, and in fact the Soviet Union offered to provide Chile with a number of Aeroflot airplanes for very low or no cost whatsoever, Chile refused that, not on ideological grounds, but on the fact that it didn't have spare parts for them. It would have to retool its entire air control system. It just didn't work. Well, what happens when you cut off aid to Chile and say, I'm sorry, these private companies can no longer provide credits to that? One of the things that happens, for example, in Chile, about two-thirds of the buses in Santiago were Fords. And when Ford is no longer lending credit to Chile to buy spare parts, buses begin to break down. And when buses break down, it means that there are fewer on the street and more people are crammed into the fewer buses that exist at the time. And so when you get to work and you're trying to get to work, the buses come by, they're absolutely packed. You stand on the step of the door into the bus. You're literally outside the bus, or as many of us did just to get to work, you'd lower the windows on the bus and you'd hang outside on the bus by holding onto the post between the windows. Well, the bus would go down these narrow Santiago streets. It would make too sharp a turn, and people would literally be crushed on the side of the building. The purpose of this is to get the large part of the population to start blaming the government for things that don't work well, that the transportation system doesn't work, that there's no supply of toilet paper and rice and cooking oil. All of these things are intended, even more than a trucker strike, to get the large group of the working class, of the middle class that sort of stands in between the two positions of hard right and hard left, to make a decision to oppose the government. And that's where the U.S. really had a terrific impact of swaying the middle class by depriving it of goods that it was used to.
I would like to talk about Pinochet's regime. I understand that he was in power until 1990, and as of date, there's more than 160 cases against him for human rights abuses during his regime. Can you talk about the impact that Pinochet had on his people during the regime?
Augusto Pinochet, who was the general of the army and the commander-in-chief of the military forces in general, was one of four members of the military junta that ruled. He soon became the primary member, largely because the army is the largest branch of the military forces. And over the next period of years, 17 years from 1973 until he finally left power in 1990, although I should say he left the presidency, he still remained as commander-in-chief of the army for most of the 1990s. And he still retained most of his power until he ultimately returned in disgrace from his arrest in London in 1998. But before that time, he had great power. I would say that on the one hand, while it was a major impressive victory to remove Pinochet from power in 1990, Pinochet in many ways did change the nature of the Chilean state in a way that still has not been undone. And let me just make a couple comments on that. One is political. Among the countries of Latin America, Chile was one of the few that actually moved backwards in terms of democratic practices, so that as opposed to having fully elected dual chambers of Congress, an upper house and lower house, now Chile is left with a Senate that has a number of appointed seats, including seats for the military, that it never had before, which means that, in fact, unelected officials are being asked to decide some of the most serious questions in Chilean history. At the same time, the military now has more of a constitutional role in political power, particularly at times of crisis, than it ever had before that time. And the second way is an economic way, and Pinochet's economic policy was one not just of market orientation, but of the most extreme form of market orientation that left the country for many years somewhat extremely vulnerable to trends in how the world economy was going. Nowadays, indices will suggest that Chile has the most open market of the world, and by that I mean that it has the least tariff protections for its own industries. In some ways, that's produced an economy that's much stronger than neighboring Argentina, for example. On the other hand, it's also left most of the workers and the poor of the country in a truly unrepresented and marginalized way. So I think, unfortunately, that Pinochet did change the nature of the state in many ways in Chile, did have a lasting impact, and the population is still trying to figure out how to deal with that.
Stephen Volk, what about the mentality of Chileans? Is there a lot of fear or apathy to politics because of Pinochet?
One of the things that Pinochet said is at the very start of his rule in 1974 is that he would stay in power until Chileans thought in a different way. And what he essentially meant by that is Chile had a long, long history of working class movements, of left-wing socialist movements, of an expectation of social community, of an expectation of political and social justice. And this is what he really wanted to have changed. I left Chile in the middle of October of 1973 and couldn't get back into the country until 1988. And what is that? That's a generation. That's 15 years in the life of a population. Somebody who was just born in 1973 would have been in the middle of high school by the time I returned. And so I was quite interested and concerned about what I would see among those people. And in a certain sense, I found at that point of time both the persistence of people who believed in those traditional aspects of social justice and struggle, as well as many who were simply too marginalized and too poor to care. I think in the present day, and I go back to Chile fairly regularly, what I'm finding is a much greater growth of apathy among the population. And that is as much the product of disappointment in the civilian governments that have come since Pinochet's ouster from power in 1990 than in what Pinochet himself has done. There was a huge sense of jubilation and hope when Pinochet left power. And I think to a certain extent, while there is, I would in no way argue that the civilian governments have been as bad as Pinochet, many of the hopes have been disappointed. And so there is much more of a sense of nobody can help us. There is no political party, large-scale political party, that really has our interests in mind. There's a lot of low-level, community-based work that goes on. But I think there is a growing sense of apathy in the political structures in general. And I saw that probably the most in my last visit earlier this year.
We have about a minute left, but can you talk a little bit about how, as an American, but as somebody who was in Chile and saw the coup happen, a coup that was very much backed by the U.S. government, how you were going into this September 11th, and what advice, how you were commemorating September 11th?
Well, September 11th, for those of us who lived through Chile, September 11th in the United States meant that we lost that in a certain sense. We lost what that meant to us. My hopes coming after September 11th in the United States is that the U.S. population in a general sense would come to share with those people in Chile a sense of, we have now all been through this together. We know what terror is like. We know what happens when airplanes rain down terror through the skies, whether it's the bombing of the Moneda or the destruction of the World Trade Centers. And my hopes would be that there would be a greater sense of empathy from us to other peoples. I'm afraid that hasn't happened, that we still, many people consider the United States as something unto itself that doesn't go through the same processes as elsewhere. And in that sense, we are all the more likely to create the mistakes of September 11th, 1973, rather than learn from them.